tomorrow. This is WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A party trench war is blazing over the ideological profile of President Bush's judicial nominees. Some say it's politics as usual. Some want to put each nominee's personal ideology front and center in the confirmation process. Some fear that more politics could end the supposed impartiality of the federal bench. Tonight on Point, ideology and the American judiciary. We begin with a look at the high tension surrounding President Bush's district and circuit court nominees. Democrats are claiming that some of them are just too conservative to be approved. Earlier, I spoke with Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. I asked him if something fundamentally new was afoot in this battle over the judiciary.
I think it's an exaggerated and an intensified version of issues we've seen before. This is a highly polarizing issue, the control of the federal judiciary. But I think the thing that's really new and the thing that makes these struggles different from so many others is that abortion is really at the core of what people are fighting about.
So people are willing to go to greater lengths to shape the judiciary?
I think that's right. I think in the Robert Bork fight during President Reagan's administration, we saw, I think, the closest approximation of what's going on now. You know, a truly political, in every sense of the word, fight over a Supreme Court nomination. But here, it's not just the Supreme Court people are fighting about. It is the circuit courts of appeals, and you have the Democrats, essentially for the first time ever, using filibusters to stop nominees who would ordinarily otherwise clearly have majority support, but they're forcing the Republicans to produce 60 votes for these nominees. And so far, at least, for these controversial ones, the Republicans have not been able to muster the votes.
So give us the overall scorecard. We've got, what, 665 district court judges, 179 appellate judges, and, of course, 9 on the Supreme Court. How many judges has President Bush nominated? How many have cleared?
Well, President Bush has nominated about 200 of the 600-plus judges in the federal courts. About 100 have already been confirmed, and clearly most of the rest will be confirmed as well. But there is a clear but small group that the Democrats have succeeded so far in stopping, led by Miguel Estrada, nominated to the D.C. Circuit, and Priscilla Owen to the Fifth Circuit, and their nominations have pretty much been stopped in their tracks.
George Bush was very clear in his presidential campaign, promising an ideological transformation of the federal judiciary. When you look at those that have already been confirmed and those in the pipeline, is he delivering? Is the president transforming the bench ideologically?
You know, as in so many areas, I think people on both ends of the political spectrum made the mistake of thinking George Walker Bush was the same person as George Herbert Walker Bush, his father, who was not a terribly ideological person. The current George Bush is a true blue conservative, and that extends to his judicial appointments. He has not completely succeeded in transforming the federal judiciary, but his nominations have been extremely conservative. The most conservative, I'd say, have been stopped so far, but many conservatives have gotten through. And I think it's just inertia, whether it's 4 or 8 years that he's president for, the vast majority clearly will get through.
Is this showing up in impact in judgments beyond abortion?
You know, it is a little early to say. When you know, the judiciary tends to move slowly. You know, these judges are just getting on the bench in significant numbers. Cass Sunstein, the professor at the University of Chicago, has done a very interesting study where he points out when you look at issues like discrimination of various kinds, Americans with Disabilities Act, affirmative action type cases, freedom of religion cases, when you start to achieve a critical mass of conservatives on the bench, particularly in the three-judge panels on which they sit, there are a significant move towards more conservative decisions. Obviously, the Supreme Court is the Super Bowl of all this, and he hasn't had any appointments there yet, but there has definitely been an impact already.
We're going to be talking with Cass Sunstein in a few minutes, but let me ask you on this issue of ideology.
the idea has been floated now that there should be a direct, explicit ideological test or examination of candidates, nominees for the federal bench, that the Senate has been dragged down into a kind of sham process because everybody wants to know these things, but they're not supposed to ask. Is that a strong movement? Would that be a historical departure?
I think it is sort of a return to what nominations to the federal bench were at the beginning of the American Republic. Senator Schumer of New York has really been outspoken on this issue, where he says, in part in reaction to the tawdry Clarence Thomas hearings, that there was an inclination on the part of many senators to make confirmations about qualifications and whether they were honest, whether they were law-abiding, whether they had any skeletons in their closet. And Schumer says, look, let's take it as a given, unless proven otherwise, that these nominees are of fine, upstanding character. But let's to see what their ideology is. Let's see if they are simply outside the mainstream, if they're too conservative, and I'm going to vote against them if they are. That has found a receptive audience, particularly among fellow Democrats, but as a more honest and straightforward way of evaluating candidates for the bench.
Well, was this same tactic thrown up against Democrats 15 or 20 years ago when Republicans wanted to know if nominees were too liberal?
You know, not really, because on these issues, Democrats sort of have, by and large, the majority positions, the politically popular positions. When you look at the confirmation hearings of Stephen Breyer and Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the Supreme Court, you see that they were very upfront about saying that they were pro-choice. What sticks in a lot of Democrats' craws is that Clarence Thomas wouldn't say whether he was pro-life or pro-choice and wouldn't even express any opinion about Roe v. Wade, and they felt somewhat snookered and misled. So I don't think the issue of ideology has hurt Democrats, at least openly. I mean, I think, in fact, the Republican Senate bottled up a lot of Clinton nominations on ideological grounds. They just didn't say it. Mm-hmm. But I think when these issues are out in the open, Democrats feel they are not at risk politically because they think the public's on their side.
And Jeff Toobin, a last question. When you look at the impact of courts over large spans of time and you see the kind of changes that are afoot now, does this produce a different America?
These issues are so profound and so important. And if you look at how the courts have changed the country, whether it's regard to race, whether it's regard to gender, whether it's regard to, you know, freedom of speech, assembly, choice. These are crucial issues, and the courts have only gotten more powerful in recent years than less. So I don't think I'm hyping the stakes to say that these are incredibly important disputes.
Jeffrey Toobin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He spoke with us from Washington. When it comes to quizzing a judicial nominee to a U.S. court, said Abraham Lincoln, we cannot ask what he will do. And if we should, and he would answer us, we should despise him for it. That was then. Now, both a Republican White House and Democrats in Congress appear to be deeply focused on the political ideology and predispositions of future judges. Democrats cry that a not-so-quiet revolution is underway and want to drop decorum and ask bottom-line ideological questions of nominees. Republicans say that's just wrong, even as they serve up nominees far to the right. It's a battle that may soon engulf nominees to the Supreme Court itself. Should ideology be the basis for approving judges? Is being too conservative a good enough reason to reject a nominee? And what about too liberal? Have we lost the model of the wise, disinterested judge? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Cass Sunstein, professor of law at the University of Chicago and co-author of the forthcoming book, Why Societies Need Dissent. In writing the book, he looked at over 10,000 judicial decisions and party affiliations to see how ideology comes into play on the bench. Good evening and welcome, Cass Sunstein.
Good evening to you.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Cass Sunstein, we're going to be looking at the whole issue of how ideology does, should not come into play in federal court nominations and the advice and consent of the U.S. Senate tonight. But I wonder if you could tell us first what you've found from your actual field survey of decisions. How much difference does it make what the constitution of a particular judicial panel is?
It makes a really huge difference. We found two things. First, Republican appointees vote much more conservatively than Democratic appointees in the cases you'd imagine, affirmative action, environmental protection, sex discrimination. But we also found something we didn't quite expect, which is that how a Democratic appointee votes and how a Republican appointee votes really depends on who they're sitting with. So a Republican appointee sitting with two other Republicans gets way conservative. A Democratic appointee sitting with two Republicans gets quite conservative. What this means is if you get three Republicans sitting together, an affirmative action program is pretty much doomed, and environmental regulations in huge trouble. Someone complaining of sex discrimination just isn't going to win. Whereas if it's three Democrats, they get very liberal, and the liberal position is overwhelmingly likely to be victorious.
And you're focused on that now because you see a Republican or conservative juggernaut coming at the federal bench?
I was really focused on this because I was interested in peer influences, how human beings influence each other. And that's really what I've been doing a lot of work on the last 2 years. And I thought studying this on the judiciary would be a pretty interesting test case. And I didn't expect to see these huge peer effects. It turns out to have a lot of implications for the current debate, but that's not why I started collecting the data.
Cass Sunstein, take us through some of these numbers, because I was fascinated at just how plainly this plays out. Can you give us a few examples of how different configurations produce different outcomes?
Yeah, if it's an all-Republican panel, three Republican appointees, and industries challenging an environmental regulation, they win about 75% of the time. So industry's in terrific shape.
That is, industry wins.
And industry wins against the Environmental Protection Agency. If it's three Republicans, three-quarters of the time, huge chance of victory. Mm-hmm. If by random draw it's three Democratic appointees, then industry's going to lose. Three-quarters of the time. Mm-hmm. So it completely flips. Three Democrats sitting together, the Environmental Protection Agency is going to win. Three Republicans sitting together, the Environmental Protection Agency is going to lose.
And if it's a mixed bench?
If it's a mixed bench, it's somewhere in the middle. So in the environmental setting, if it's two Republicans and a Democrat, the industry wins about 45% of the time. Almost half. So, if it's a Republican and two Democrats, they win about 38% of the time.
So does that suggest to you, Cass Sunstein, that there's a national interest in having a diverse makeup on federal benches, or is that implicit?
Yeah, that's my implication, that since three Democrats are super liberal and three Republicans are super conservative, and you don't get equal justice that way, there's a real national interest in ensuring that the federal judiciary is diverse.
Jack Beatty, at the same time, presidents, at least of late, come in pushing judges of their own political persuasion and pushing fairly aggressively.
Yes, and when they're two-term presidents, they can get more of them in. In the Reagan-Bush years, we had 12 years of appointees. But, you know, the country is 48-48. The last election, presidential election, was 48-48. The House and Senate, in terms of percentage of votes, are about that, 48-48. And the risk of these, of some of the nominees the president has put forward, and the risk of, you know, the sort of vetting they're given, this kind of Federalist Society imprimatur that they have to be, you know, X-chromosome conservatives, you can get those configurations pretty fast on these federal benches. And suddenly you get a courts that are not 48-48 at all, that they are, you know, 75-25 in terms of the rights of the individual against the state or against powerful private interests.
And so does that mean, Cass Sunstein, let me put it to you, is that necessarily wrong? Are the courts intended to reflect public opinion or to reflect an interpretation of the Constitution which may be entirely their own?
Well, they're supposed to reflect interpretation of the law, but what my numbers show is that the law is ambiguous in the hard cases, and it's not so good when the Democrats push the law hard to the left and Republicans push the law hard to the right, when what they're really doing is using their own own, you know, their own evaluations to push the law in the direction when they want when there's ambiguity.
And so we've got senators right now, Democratic senators, saying, let's talk about ideology up front. We're looking at ideology, the battle royal over the face of the federal courts and the shape of the America that will emerge. Are we getting a radical right-wing judiciary or just balancing the scales here? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is 051. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about ideology, the battle royal over the face of the federal courts, and the shape of the America that will emerge. You can join the conversation. Should ideology be the basis for the U.S. Senate approving federal nominees to the federal bench? Is it already the basis? Should nominees to the federal bench be rejected because they're too conservative or too liberal? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Chicago by Cass Sunstein. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago. And joined now from New York by John McGinnis, professor of law at Northwestern University. He's author of Presidential Review as Constitutional Restoration. He clerked for Ken Starr on the U.S. Court of Appeals. Good evening and welcome, John McGinnis.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. John, you've heard some of this conversation. We're trying to dig in tonight to the role of ideology as the Senate performs its role of advice and consent on nominees to the federal bench. Cass Sunstein has looked at the numbers and come to the conclusion that it makes a difference what the makeup of a bench is, and particularly when it becomes unanimously right or left, it swings very widely one direction or the other. You know the long tradition of trying to keep ideology out of the questioning that goes into a nominee, but what do you think today? Should there be a kind of ideological test or examination, or is that wrong?
Well, first of all, I can't comment on Professor Sunstein's very interesting study, as I've not looked at it. But let me say, make three points, essentially, about looking at ideology. And the first point I'd make is that I think it's very important to distinguish jurisprudence from ideology. Most people's understanding what ideology means is sort of their bottom line political views. Is abortion a good thing or a bad thing?
Mm-hmm.
Is affirmative action a good thing or a bad thing? What the Constitution certainly requires us to do is not ask that question, but are these various actions protected or prohibited by the Constitution? And that's a different question, calling for, in my view, a completely different methodology, a methodology of jurisprudential consideration, for instance. In my view, according to, you should interpret the Constitution according to its text, its original understanding. And that's what the debate, I think, in the Senate should be about. And I have no problem with that kind of debate. It's important to have that distinction because, after all, the reason we have judicial review is because, precisely because the framers thought that the judiciary brought a kind of neutral judgment of what the Constitution meant, not just a question about what the political value should be. After all, we have the representatives to do that. If we were thought they could make those judgments, if we felt that ideology could defend our constitutional principles, we wouldn't need judicial review. And so that's my first point. There's a danger in moving down the row to ideology.
John McGinnis, let's hold just on that point for the moment. I want to get to your other two, but that's a very beefy one right there. Cass Sunstein, I guess I'd like to get your response here. First of all, are we bringing, are the nominees being selected to bring neutral judgment to the bench? And do you agree with John McGinnis that inquiring beyond their approach to interpreting the Constitution is inappropriate?
I think he makes a good distinction. It's a little fancy, but I think it's right that we don't want to ask, you know, does a judge like abortion or dislike abortion? We want to ask what the judge thinks about the Constitution. But I guess I'd say that most of my data really doesn't involve the Constitution. It's like there's a sex discrimination claim under law that forbids sex discrimination, not the Constitution, or some Environmental Protection Agency regulation is being challenged by industry. Industry wins a lot before Republicans, and the woman complaining of sex discrimination loses a lot.
But how can you take the Constitution out of that equation? Isn't that the touchstone?
No, the cases I'm talking about just I wasn't clear enough. Sorry, just aren't constitutional questions. There's under federal law. There's a federal law that forbids sex discrimination and that tells the EPA what it can and can't do.
Are you suggesting then that these do boil down to ideology? phraseology, not constitutional interpretation?
Well, the cases I'm just talking about just don't involve the Constitution. There isn't a constitutional issue in those cases.
John McGinnis, how about that? Does that then leave the judge?
I certainly can't comment on Professor Sunstein's study. I would say that even in statutory cases, there are very important jurisprudential issues. And it is not the case, at least I can't say that it's the case, that there should be any sort of particular percentage of industry versus plaintiffs winning in any cases. I want to look at the question of whether there are jurisprudential cross-cutting issues, as there often are even in statutory cases. So jurisprudential interpretation is at issue in every case, whether it's a constitutional case or not. I was referring to constitutional cases because that's what I had understood to be the issue before us.
John McGinnis, you had a couple of other points we'd like to hear.
Yes. Well, secondly, I think the question is how well is the Senate going to be in processing the question of people's jurisprudential views or certainly their ideology? And I think the question is they're not likely to do it in a very fair way. And what we're likely to see if we inject ideology, particularly at the lower court level, I think with the Supreme Court, jurisprudential views may need to be front and center. But there are a tradition of looking largely at qualifications and competence at the lower courts, I think has served us well. The danger of going down the other route is a very practical danger, that what's going to happen is we're going to get, and what's happening already, is we're going to get a kind of partisan cycle of escalation, where we've done something bad to your nominee, so when we're back into power, we're going to do something bad to the other sides, and we're just going to miss out, actually, on some very good nominees because of that. My sense is both the Republicans and the Democrats, when they try to knock off nominees in this way, actually don't knock off even the most jurisprudentially conservative nominees or jurisprudentially liberal nominees. They look for targets of opportunity, and I think that's a real danger in the long term, because I think we actually would be advantaged by having people of differing jurisprudential views and differing distinctive views, and what's likely to happen is we're going to have more people whose record is who's unclear. And so that is a sort of practical danger, I think, of going down this road. We're already seeing it.
John McGinnis, stand by. Jack Beattie, I want to get you to look at that very point. And John McGinnis talks about the danger of a partisan cycle of nominations where people try and knock off what they perceive to be the most extreme nominees, or presumably the other side of that equation is that the presidents nominate robustly partisan or ideological nominees because someone else did. Are we already deep into that cycle here?
Well, I think Chuck Schumer really suggested as much in some hearings a couple of years ago, where he said basically that tacitly ideology has been used as a test. It's just that no one has come out and said it, so people have looked for proxies. You know, how were your ethics? You know, what were your law board grades? How did the American Bar Association vet you? Instead of coming right out and saying, well, let's talk about your political ideology. And, you know, Professor McGinnis talks about jurisprudence as distinct from ideology, and yet inevitably, ideology construes the Constitution, construes and affects the jurisprudence. I'm thinking, you know, let's just get concrete about this. There's a nominee who's been put before the Senate, a woman from California. Alas, I've forgotten her name.
Carolyn Cool.
Yes, who in a decision out there, well, you have to put yourself in the position of the person, I guess, in the decision. A woman went into a doctor's office to get a breast exam, and there was someone else there. And that person turned out to be a drug salesman. And the drug salesman, and I guess the doctor, I'm not sure, were making comments about the woman and made her blush and feel very uncomfortable. She sued as violating her privacy and so on. And this judge did not fine for her at all and was overruled, I think, unanimously by the appeals court. Now, that's not just a matter of, you know, objective jurisprudence. There's a kind of ideological meanness there that I mean, if you put your wife in the position of that woman, if you put your mother in the position of that woman, the outrage of it just shrieks out at you.
If I may
somehow,
just,
And somehow this woman, the judge, just didn't see it that way at all.
John McGinnis.
Yes, I must say, I think those comments demonstrate exactly the danger of the road we're going down. We haven't discussed at all the legal issues in the case of what the statute was, of how it should be interpreted. We've only looked at the emotional fact that someone has lost their case. That is not the question of whether a decision is right or wrong. And I quite understand. And what is going to happen is both sides are going to take cases that are as emotional as this, on the right and the left, and are going to use it to attack judges. And it's going to be very hard for the Senate to process this in a fair way, because the whole incentives will be to try to find spectacular facts and actually ignore the question of whether the decision is right. On the right, they'll try to find criminals, I'm sure, who've been let off, who've done egregious crimes, and maybe have been let off on the basis of some constitutional right. They maybe should have been left off.
We've got it, John McGinnis. Cass Sunstein, come in here. John McGinnis is kind of saying, let's settle down and stay sober here, but is it not possible that while that's going on, a particular president could be loading the bench with highly partisan judges? You were quoted in Jeffrey Toobin's article saying that this administration has a radical agenda, in your phrase, when it comes to the courts.
Well, I don't think I said that, but I can say some things that I would say. One is that the Republican view that we should just let the president do this and not consider ideology is hilarious. It's one of the funniest jokes, really, in the last decade. Senator Hatch, as the Senate Judiciary, made crystal clear that if President Clinton nominated a liberal, and that was his term, forget it. No hearing. Elena Kagan, my former colleague, now the dean of the Harvard Law School, a moderate, didn't get a hearing. Why? Because she was too liberal. So the really vicious stuff about stopping people, this was done under the Clinton administration, and the much more open and mostly very passive and hooray for President Bush approach, which has been basically the approach of the Senate Democrats. There's just a handful of cases in which they've made noise. So this hilarious joke about judicial neutrality and the need for Senate deference to the president, I don't know what Professor McGinnis's position was under President Clinton. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt, but let's just have a good laugh about the right-wing enthusiasm for Senate deference.
I want to bring our callers in, Cass Sunstein, if you'll allow me. Ron's calling from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Yes. I believe that we really have to take ideology into consideration. George Bush, as you were just saying, George Bush, has an agenda here. The Republicans have an agenda to overturn Roe versus Wade. And, that's a very important issue to a lot of people. I believe that the majority of Americans favor Roe versus Wade and don't want to see that overturned. I mean, we have to protect our rights. I see it as a way of protecting our liberties.
So you don't see a choice, but when you hear people say, "Well, just settle down, Ron, and let's just soberly look at their record of Jewish prudential interpretation," are you not calmed by that?
No, absolutely not. No, I'm not. No, we have to take action, because the right wing is gunning to overturn Roe versus Wade, and
Ron, thanks for your call. John McGinnis, how about it?
I would just say that President Bush shouldn't be demonized here, and that he's nominated some very good moderate people.
Oh, I'm sorry, Cass Sunstein.
Yeah, so maybe you would expect that from Professor McGinnis, but I wouldn't say that President and maybe future Professor Bush has a radical right-wing agenda. I just don't believe that's true. And I think he's appointed a mixture of people, and some of them are very, very good. And what we want is some cooperation between the executive and legislative branches.
Well, that seems a moderate line. But, Ron, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
So here's Cass Sunstein saying President Bush is putting some good people up for the bench. Are you appeased by that?
With all due respect, I do not agree, and I'm not appeased by that at all. I think this is a war. We're at war here.
Ron, thanks for your call. John McGinnis,
you know how this is characterized in some quarters. It's as though President Bush is, there's a kind of masquerade here. Republicans don't want to talk about this, as perhaps Democrats didn't want to 10 or 15 years ago when they had a majority, that there's a kind of, Republican judges being put up consistently very conservative as kind of fundamentalist mullahs who are, you know, whipping America into a kind of conservative box canyon. Do you see?
Well, I do find that quite amusing. We don't seem to be tending to fundamentalism. But let me just be very clear. I certainly believe it's perfectly appropriate and always certainly constitutional for any senator to vote against the nominee on the basis of their jurisprudential views, and certainly at the Supreme Court level. I think it even practically makes sense. Only a few, fairly few Supreme Court judges. Over time, things aren't likely to even out with presidents, necessarily with Democrat and Republican presidents. But all I'm suggesting is that debate should be a jurisprudential debate. We need to have norms to do that. Otherwise, we're going to have a dissent into questions of, well, what do I believe? How do I believe the Constitution should come out as a policy matter?
But don't we already have that? You know how much resistance there was to nominees under the Clinton administration. Now we see some fierce resistance under the Bush administration. Isn't that a sign that we are already in that position?
No, I don't think we've descended as far as we could go down that road. The question is why to oppose nominees. And I think it's very important to oppose them if you are opposing them because you believe that they are sort of systematically interpreting the Constitution in a different, in an incorrect way, rather than to say, well, I don't like them because they have this position on X, Y, or Z.
And what about nominees who just won't be forthcoming about their position? Several Bush nominees have been nearly mute on the stand.
Well, I'm not quite sure they've been mute on the stand. There's no doubt that if a nominee doesn't answer any questions, a senator can vote against them. That's not, I think, I don't think there's any doubt that they have the constitutional right to do that. But I think that what they should be asking for is how to approach the Constitution rather than what their views are on particular cases. That starts to move us for judges who are actually sort of taking focus groups and trying to figure out what are the decisions that they should predict they're going to have. It'll get them confirmed.
Jack Beatty, our caller Ron, says, look, we've got a country at war here over important rights and issues. John McGinnis and to some extent Cass Sunstein are saying, well, there's still moderation in nominations, and let's not go any further down the road toward assuming there won't be.
Well, I think that's been the case. I mean, the president has had, nearly 100 judges approved, and some of them even, I think, many unanimously. And the issue is really over 4 or 5. So it does seem to me there's some consensus there. But it's the issue really with some of these nominees of how egregious they seem. Yes, as against, I suppose, a kind of social consensus. I'm not a constitutional expert, but I do feel that when judges look at the Constitution, I want a judge who's going to secure my rights. I think that's what every American wants. And that's when you apply that standard to some of these judges, it just doesn't seem that that's the way they see it.
Listeners, we're talking tonight about ideology, the battle royal over the face of the federal courts. You can join the conversation should nominees to the federal bench be rejected as too conservative or too liberal. If ideology is the standard for appointment, should we just elect federal judges? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
909-9287.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about ideology and the battle over the face of the federal courts. You can join the conversation. Should nominees to the federal bench be rejected if they are deemed too conservative or too liberal? Or is that irrelevant? Is it all about constitutional interpretation? My guests tonight are Cass Sunstein, joining us from Chicago. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago. And John McGinnis, professor of law at Northwestern University, joining us tonight from New York. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Susan is on the line. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling stimulated by the statistical thoughts that were brought up by one of your speakers.
Cass Sunstein, yes.
And I'm thinking that if you just consider that if the rate of cases per person brought before the federal judges since the founding of the country were to remain the same, and you take into consideration the population growth that has occurred in the meantime and the economic growth.
Okay, where are we going here, Susan?
I'm then leading us to the fact that there would be an increase in the number of cases brought to the federal judges in a 365-day period. And then if you layer on top of that the number of personal privacy and environmental issues and laws that have evolved over that 150 to 200-year period, that means that the rate of cases that is coming before a judge with lifetime appointment is increasing dramatically each and every year, which means that the vacillation introduced to the system by a strongly political judge could be enormous.
You mean that the wheel could turn very sharply right or left depending on the political character or the constitutional view. Hang on, Kastenstein, does that add up to you?
Yeah, the projection from our numbers is if we had had Democratic presidents for a number of years, then the law would have shifted very dramatically to the left. Affirmative action programs would be upheld. People complaining of sex discrimination would win. Abortion laws would be struck down. Capital punishment would be struck down, not always, but a lot more than now. And if we have Republican presidents for a long, long time, there's going to be a very radical shift to the right. And I think all the talk about jurisprudence and stuff shouldn't mask the fact, which is that the concrete outcomes and the trend shape of the law will shift very radically. Now, that might be good, but it shouldn't be ignored.
Susan, what do you think we ought to do about that?
Well, I think we should. I think we have several choices. I'm not sure which would be the correct one. Perhaps a combination. We could evaluate judges for their neutrality, as we do now in this attempt to look at them before they're appointed. We could do that.
But when you say neutrality, you mean political or explicitly ideological?
Political neutrality, yeah. Either based on the decisions that they have done prior to the appointment or decisions that they do after they are appointed.
So they're demonstrated neutrality.
Mm-hmm. We could also do away with lifetime appointments, but I fear that if we went down that road, we would be removing the one protection that we have so that judges can use their accumulated lifetime wisdom regardless of pressures from political sources, just as tenured professors have the right to pursue what they perceive as the truth based on their research, regardless of the pressures that political sources may bring to bear on
it. Susan, you bring a lot of great points. Thanks so much for calling. John McGinnis, what about it? Is it possible to measure demonstrated neutrality in a particular judge's record of decisions? And I guess bearing in mind, as you think about that, what Kastenstein is looking at outcomes, and there are measurable outcomes.
Well, again, I can't comment on his study, but I can say that there are ways of doing that to look whether people are consistent. For instance, if they're textualists, consistently rule on textualism basis, even when that seems to be the conservative result. I would note that there are at least some instances in which Justice Scalia has ruled, in some sense, what would be thought to be a very liberal policy matter in confrontation clause cases, because he takes a very textual result. That would be one way of evaluating whether someone is applying their principles neutrally.
And what about Kastenstein is pointing out that if you had a Democratic White House for many years or a Republican White House for many years?
I think that is interesting. Well, of course, one issue, of course, is one reason that is unlikely to happen over the long term is that if we did have, for instance, to take the example of judges against capital punishment taking extremely liberal results, I think that would start to become an issue in the presidential campaign.
So a self-correcting mechanism.
So there is a kind of self-correcting mechanism, and I tend to think that's the better place to put the argument. That may be the interesting question of here. The hard issue, of course, is we want judges to not decide things politically. On the other hand, there needs to be some political accountability through, and the question is, where are we going to place that accountability? I'm more comfortable in having that in the president and having those debates more at the presidential election level.
Kastenstein, let me put this to you, and I just really don't know. I've never really thought about it, but does the American public have some right to consistency in the rights that they're afforded? Right to assume that once a right has been established, that rights accrete, that they don't, that the whole kind of shape of national law and expectations around behavior and legality and illegality won't veer all over the place over time?
Well, that's why we have a rules of stare decisis. You know, the courts are supposed to respect their own precedents. But we maybe shouldn't make a theology of that, because if, you know, suppose the abortion case, Roe against Wade, was not just wrong, but really horribly wrong, and it was, you know, not a good interpretation of the Constitution at all, then it would be reasonable, if you thought that, to think that it should be overruled. And if some people are hesitating hearing that, note that some of our most dramatic and celebrated decisions, like the one forbidding school segregation, overruled precedent, and the very decisions which said that sex discrimination is unacceptable, those decisions overruled precedent. So I do think that people have a right to a degree of consistency over time, but the court shouldn't be, you know, stuck in stuff when it's clearly wrong.
So they can go right, they can go left, they can go right again.
Well, I think if they're moving really dramatically in one direction or another, then they're not really like judges, because judges are supposed to pay attention to their own precedent. I'll tell you something that bothers me in my data most, which is that if by luck of the draw you have three Democratic judges on your panel, three-judge panels, in one of these kind of controversial cases, if you're on the liberal side, you're overwhelmingly likely to win. But if by luck of the draw you get three Republicans, you're overwhelmingly likely to lose.
So there's an inconsistency across the country in that case.
Yeah, and that's an inequality problem. It's not just across the country. It's like in individual cities. In Chicago, you know, we have some Democratic appointees and some Republican appointees. So, too, in Boston and New York.
And there you get a kind of tiger-striped a tiger stripe of ideology within the courts. I want to get another call here. Gary's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you.
My comment was that if the Senate reviews the nomination and we have an elected official and his staff, obviously, providing the nomination, the democratic process is essentially at work, and that any sort of political swing to the left or the right ultimately would reflect the views of the country in electing these officials.
And so let it be. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it, because I think we had said just slightly earlier that it, to some degree, will be self-righting.
But, Gary, if let's just say hypothetically you had a White House that was putting up really right-leaning or really left-leaning candidates, but the Senate wasn't permitted to speak to that because that got into the realm of ideology, then is there a kind of masquerade that would worry you here or not?
I guess that depends. You know, I wouldn't be enough an expert on decorum at that level and to know at what limits these questions would be asked. But I would think we have a pretty bright group of legislators that could craft their questions in a way that ultimately, or look at either some judicial record that would determine what these political bendings might be.
Gary, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, how about it? Do you see that there's a notion floating up here that, that there will be a kind of self-righting mechanism to this whole system? But given that, the cries from the Democrats now are awfully loud.
Well, yeah, I think one problem with that is that the character of the sort of conservative intellectualette, if I can kind of coin a phrase, I mean, I believe there is a kind of drive toward logical consistency among conservative legal thinkers, whether it's originalism or whatever it is, or whether it's the kind of thing that comes through the Federalist Society. What I'm terribly afraid of is the sort of mixed verdict that you get with a politician is all boiled out with some of these intellectual judges. And it's a matter of you know, in other words, they take it to the limit. They take the idea, for example, that the state, that Congress shouldn't be involved in the sort of legislation it was involved in the New Deal. That's one of the things that could be at stake here. The whole idea that Congress can regulate all sorts of matters having to do with property and the like. And my fear is that, you know, people could wake up one day and those protections would just be gone because these judges had a kind of take it to the limit outlook and there was no mitigation on these panels precisely because you had year after year after year of Federalist Society nominees.
Cass Sunstein, I'm a bit afraid to quote you here from The New Yorker after your last response, but you're quoted again saying that you're referring to conservative judges being put up. You're saying they're against Roe. They're also against Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. They want to restore the status quo ante from about 1934. Do you see the danger that Jack Beatty's describing?
Yes, absolutely. And that quote is real, and I stand by it. And I'll tell you, there's been a very dramatic shift in right-wing thought, where for a number of years, the Warren Court, you know, and judicial activism was the big target, and Roe against Wade was the bad decision. The shift in the last 20 years, and it's really not been sufficiently taken account of, is towards kind of movement conservatives as judges who think that the worst guy really wasn't Earl Warren, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the real Constitution, and here I'm quoting a distinguished federal judge on the D.C. Circuit, the real Constitution is in exile, and that was the Constitution in about 1934. Now, that Constitution not only allowed segregation and sex discrimination, it prohibited state and federal governments from doing a lot of things to protect people.
And are you suggesting, Cass Sunstein, that this judge in particular would welcome back sex and race discrimination?
Not as a political matter. He doesn't like those things, and he's as a judge, he's constrained by precedent. But he has been making public pleas, and this isn't a wild man. This is really a good guy who's very intellectual. He's an originalist. He says the Constitution is in exile. And what we need to bring back is the one from 34, and it's up to, you know, young people and the future judges to do that. Now, I don't think most of President Bush's nominees want to do that, but I bet you a couple of them do, and John, that is genuinely dangerous.
John McGinnis, do you see that pendulum swinging so radically?
I think that's very unlikely. I think it's quite clear that judge is speaking not about race and sex discrimination, but about some of the federalism issues with respect to some of the Wicker v. Filburn and some of the Commerce Clause.
The role of the federal government, but those are quite substantial issues themselves.
Yes, they are substantial issues, and I see no prospect that unless we have a real revolution in thought, that those cases are going to be overruled. This is liquidated precedent. Different branches have agreed to this for many years, and I think is extremely stable. And I think there's really no suggestion that President Bush, by nominating a few conservative intellectuals to the appellate court, can shake those decisions.
Cass Sunstein, I want to ask you, because you've raised it with the numbers that you brought forward, if you don't like to see these concentrations of party affiliation on particular panels, do you suggest a remedy?
Yeah, I think there are two things that should happen. First, the president and the Judiciary Committee should get together and make some compromises. They shouldn't ask particular people particular questions. They should try to get a slate of people who's mutually agreeable. I also think, and this is, I think, a more controversial suggestion, that every effort should be made so that when Americans are before courts of appeals, they're not sitting before three Republican appointees or three Democratic appointees, that some mechanism should be built into the system so to the extent feasible they get both groups on their, at least one person from both parties on their panel. That is a recipe for moderation and equality before the law.
But also a recipe for bringing political affiliation and ideology right to the front in a way it never has been. Very interesting. Cass Sunstein, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Cass Sunstein is professor of law at the University of Chicago, author of the forthcoming Why Societies Need Dissent. And John McGinnis, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
John McGinnis is professor of law at Northwestern University and author of Presidential Review as Constitutional Restoration. Jack Beatty, what do you think?
Well, you know, that picture of justice being stacked against you, if the three members of a party of the same party are on that bench, that's kind of scary. That says equal protection of the laws is out the book. I think it should worry anybody with business before the federal courts. You've got to ask first, who appointed these judges?
Yeah, Jack, if you ever get vulnerable or get bad, watch out where you do it.
Oh, boy.
Thanks.
Don't do it in Virginia.
Not in Virginia. Thanks for being with us, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.